Chapter 6. I call my own number just to hear my husband's voice again. Mourner's trips to the past. A far more certain what's next after death, at least for the survivors, is bereavement counseling, also known as aftercare in the funeral home industry. The social worker or chaplain on the hospice team provides this to the survivors for about a whole year after the person passes. As I might say with the leavening of a little humor to family at this time, it's not like we drop you like a hot potato. We are available to call or visit. I then give the details of our programs that help grievers. But nothing in life, not even grieving, can be boxed into a certain time period. You cannot even say, well, now that your loved one is gone, your grieving will kick into gear. The real deal is that except in the most sudden kinds of death, the grieving gets rolling in advance as you anticipate a death looming on the horizon, and you start to take in what that might be like. Harvey, a spouse of one of my patients, had been married for decades to Lucy. He kept visiting her in the nursing home even after she no longer recognized him. I first met Harvey when I saw him pushing her in her wheelchair in the refreshing breezes scented with evergreen just outside the front entrance. The only change that got him to cut the visits to her way down was when Lucy's anxiety ratcheted way up whenever he appeared. She saw him as a disturbing and unpredictable intrusion into her daily routine. For instance, she got irritable and would not eat when he tried to feed her, while she ate on cue when the health aide fed her. What a blow to find that your spouse is more comfortable and connected with a stranger than yourself. Harvey knew that emotionally and spiritually she was gone from him. After that, he was very receptive to my visiting him at his own home, where he could access a laptop for us to study scripture. One way he coped with his wife no longer relating to him as her husband was for him to plunge into religious study. He was a very devout Christian, but found my Jewish orientation intellectually stimulating and not off-putting at all. Somehow, on a previous visit to his home, we had gotten around to the subject of the Jewish holiday of Purim, and to the story about it in the Book of Esther. After I had outlined the highlights of this story, which included the heroes Mordecai and Esther and the villain Haman, he wanted to hear me read it to him the next time I came over. When I did come by that next time, he said, "Well, I very much would like you to read from the Book of Sarah like we talked about." The Book of Sarah? I puzzled over that, thinking that would be great if there were such a thing. Such a book would let Sarah co-star with the more famous Abraham and get another woman in the Bible to figure prominently. Then I figured out he meant the Book of Esther. So I went online and found a pleasantly fluid English translation. And as I read it aloud, I paused a lot so Harvey could bring the Bible alive by linking it to his own life. The mass destruction in the story, indirectly resulting from Haman's attempt to wipe out the Jews, made Harvey think about the September 11th World Trade Center disaster. His eyes downcast, he spoke of his son-in-law, who had worked as an elevator repairman in the Twin Towers. He had gone into one of the towers to help firefighters get supplies up elevators, and not understanding the nature of the risk, forfeited his life for doing so. We talked about this for such a long time, the laptop reverted to the screensaver, which displayed a commemorative design about the 9/11 disaster. Harvey lamented, "In the Purim story, that guy Mordecai prevented the massacre of the Jews. On 9/11, the massacre was not prevented." Perhaps you're wondering what I said to that, as it put God in a very bad light. What? Did Harvey mean to say, God screwed up that second time? I knew that anything but silence and a sympathetic nod, even if I were to present the most watertight, elegant, and moving defense on the mysterious ways of God, would have insulted his son-in-law's memory and comforted no one but myself. No. The sacredness I seek to preserve and foster in such an encounter is not centered on the Lord up there, but on Harvey, who felt he could critique God without my censorship. I was trying to bear witness to the authentic struggles in his heart, to make sense of tragedy and to his complete trust and ease with sharing such forbidden sentiments. He may, now that he brought his negative thought out into the open, in the future feel freer to come up with a revised image of God that fits the facts. By the way, I feel the imperative to keep quiet about God and evil all the more so when Holocaust survivors speak their mind. Who am I, who have never experienced even a single 100th of their horrors, to have the audacity and hubris to explain away any of their suffering? They are not only mourning the deaths of friends and relatives, but the demise of Jewish Eastern European culture, and of a huge percentage of people. I can only humbly listen and hope they do not think my representing belief in God, or even representing a belief in life's meaning, is as absurd as excusing God in some way for evil. Seeing Holocaust survivors has been about the most difficult aspect of my job. Here they are, facing death after having seen so much death, including for some, the death of God. I feel at my most powerless, wondering if it is insulting to overtly offer anything spiritual. Why do they want to see me? To tell God off? To disabuse me of naive notions? To check out every possible angle for a restoration of meaning or hope? I remember a telephone call from the sister of a recently deceased survivor, where we were discussing the source of evil. When I mentioned the Jewish mystical view that evil comes from imbalances in the universe, for example, from power getting out of hand, she scoffed. "That's ridiculous! What insulting nonsense!" I was not about to argue the point or ask her to explain further, as much as she piqued my curiosity. A fact about Holocaust survivors that had puzzled me for a very long time was the large number of them who wanted to be cremated. I thought doing that was like giving Hitler yet more posthumous victories, given the fiery disposal of the Nazis dictated for the remains of many of the Holocaust victims. Cremation also violates Jewish law, and some rabbis will not even officiate at a funeral involving cremation. Well, one day I was reading a newsletter for Jewish chaplains, and the answer popped out at me. They want cremation because they want to feel connected with other Holocaust victims, who perhaps were friends and family, whose fate was likewise ashes to ashes. Maybe in a bizarre way, this amounts to survival guilt, in that they do not want the privilege of burial. Getting back to Harvey, after he had dwelt enough on the almost equally dreary topic of 9/11, he moved on to topics that gave him, and me, and maybe you now reading this, respite. This is what many patients and family members do, and so it is quite common within the space of one visit to jump from spiritual devastation to their grandson's upcoming birthday party. This time, the source of respite was me. That is, Harvey asked what I have been up to these days. I told him I started writing my very first fiction piece called Upward Spiral. He said two very encouraging things. First, unlike most people who say they're going to write, you're really writing. And when you finish your book, I want to be the first one to buy it. And so a hospice visit is often like any other slice of life, filled with the bitter and the sweet, the important and the trivial, the humorous and the serious, the incongruous and the ordinary. After that visit, I did not get to see him again, because as his daughter explained, his own health deteriorated to the point that he no longer wanted visits. Eventually, because he had to budget his energy more and more, he could not return my calls at all. When I describe my work to people I come across, such as unsuspecting fellow bed and breakfast guests, whom my husband and I meet on our travels, they can express discomfort with my dealing with bereavement just as much as with the kind of work I do while the patient is still alive. I'm sure some of that discomfort is about their own unease with unfinished grieving or with grief work they anticipate coming up in the future. On the flip side, while this book was in progress, people would tell me I absolutely had to put into the book such and such a grief issue they themselves were currently wrestling with. One day, our very exuberant and outspoken financial planner had dropped over to our home and settled on our sofa for a moment of relaxation. The ponderous book, Treatment of Complicated Mourning, by Dr. Therese Rando, was hard to miss as it lay on the cloverleaf table we were sitting in front of. Complicated means that the extent of grieving is an awfully tough go without the help of a therapist. It also means that the grief is so overwhelming that even after some time has passed, such grievers cannot function at work or take care of themselves as they normally do, or think about anything else. Or they may engage in substance abuse, or they may act as if the person who passed did not actually die. In essence, complicated grieving is unhealthy grieving. By the way, this is not to say that the run-of-the-mill griever would not benefit from counsel. Grieving has got to be one of the hardest things we mortals are called upon to do in our lifetime. Dr. Rando's tome goes into excruciating detail about the causes of complicated mourning, giving you all you wanted to know about it and then some. These causes run the gamut of a largely toxic relationship with the deceased, to sudden death, to dealing with multiple deaths within a short period, to not wanting to stop grieving for fear of forgetting the loved one entirely. I gestured to the book saying I had decided to learn more about grief and counseling. His response to my endeavor? I could never get into that. People are complicated enough as it is when the patient's still alive. He perhaps unintentionally made a pun. Grieving, even so-called uncomplicated grieving, piles on layers and layers of complexity to one's life, forcing up issues past and present, disrupting family structures and foisting new roles upon the griever. And that is just for starters. Added to that is the uneven progress that mourners make. Instead of gradually feeling better, there is usually a wrenching back and forth between pain over the loss and taking pleasure in sweet memories and current life. But to tell the truth, and this truth may reassure some of you who are going through this, when I journey long enough with people in bereavement, I often witness spiritual and emotional healing. Ordinarily, the end result of grieving is not death or deterioration, but renewed life. Most people go on, after sufficient time, to life-affirming activities such as making new friends or emotionally reinvesting in a new cause or new project. The knowledge of their loved one's passing now is somewhat softened, though perpetual ache. This is how I described grief in one of my eulogies. Grieving is a complex process, not a linear progression from more grief to less grief. It's more of a moving forward and a moving back, of taking detours and then suddenly discovering shortcuts, of passing through stretches of tiresome roadways, alternated with interludes of peaceful countryside. It is the disorienting journey that will bring you of necessity to a new place, to a renewed place. Yet the same as when I visit with families while their loved one is still alive, I never know what I'm going to face when I enter a survivor's front door or when they answer the phone. I have run into everything from small talk and affectionate memories to total relief that the son of a gun is thanks to be heaven finally gone, to a woman whose distress was so severe she wanted me to tell her how to check herself into a mental clinic on the spot. The answer to the latter is to have the griever report to the ER and ask for psychiatric assistance. Then there was the telephone call I made to a mourner who one time told me about an unquestionably peculiar telephone call of her own. Over the months, I had been calling Samantha to see how she was coming along. I had seen her while her husband was still alive, scarcely arousable even for a prayer short enough to be on Twitter. During our last call, she had asked about resources for getting through the prodigious paperwork related to the will or Medicare or some such financial matter. This time, she told me something so bizarre about her attempt to contact those resources, I just kept talking because my brain said for a while, "This does not compute." Samantha had called some government official or other, and he in turn gave her a number to call to obtain some advice of some sort.
"But when I dialed the number," she said, "I got a recording that said, 'Free sex.' I thought I had dialed the wrong number, and so I called again and I heard the same thing. 'Free sex.'"
After she repeated this again, it finally registered on me, and I first said, "No way." And then I found it irresistible to joke. "And so did you ask when and where?" It was a good thing I restrained myself from adding, "and for how long." So we both had some fun with that before I went on to commiserate with her about the disconcerting element of a surprise. From a very unanticipated corner, a government phone number assumed to be associated with Medicare information has got to be the most unlikely conduit to sex talk I have ever heard of, even if an impressive percentage of government officials partake of sexual activity, free and otherwise. Such stories from mourners are the exception. The usual dialogue I have with them is about their memories of the deceased and how much their loved one meant to them, or how someone else in the picture had meant more. Take, for example, Kathy, a vibrant 83-year-old who subjected all comers to her home to slushy semi-classical tunes emanating from hidden speakers high and low. I visited her about once a month for almost a year after the death. She would sit me down at her kitchen table and feed me some very healthy granola cookies I made myself. We are not supposed to eat during the job, partly because of the potential to spread disease, but homemade cookies were too hard to pass up. As she ushered me in, there was always a curious tension between her enthusiastic tone of voice and pleasure in seeing me and her assertion that she was in agony over her husband's death. She had a very involved story to tell, and that is why she had so much to sort out. The man who died, named Roger, was her second husband, who she had wed just 6 years earlier. Her first husband did not die until after 55 years of marriage. All that time, she had known Roger, the one she was eventually going to marry, and had not cared much about the first husband. Not care much is an understatement. She said he brought out her meanness, and consequently she dished out plenty of it back to him. She found herself in the predicament that she first had to wait for Roger's spouse, and then for her own to die to fulfill her heart's desire. Her life had been like having her plate piled up with an uninspiring entree, and then after managing to get every last mouthful down so as not to offend the host, i.e. society, she only just brushed her tongue against a smidgen of a long-awaited sumptuous dessert before most of it was whisked away. During the course of the year, she had to sort out her sadness, the loss of her role as wife, her resentment at having to stick it out with her first husband and being cheated of time with Roger, and possibly guilt for not having cared all that much about her first husband. Every time we met, she described Roger in luscious romantic terms.
When we were in the car, I was glad when we stopped at a red light because that gave us an opportunity for another kiss. Or, I have left Roger's voice on our answering machine and I call my own number just to hear his sweet voice again. And every time we ate breakfast, it was like going out on a date.
This for sure raised the bar for me on what constitutes romantic behavior. More fundamentally, hearing such tales on the job is a reminder to cherish loved ones while we can, which is one more reason to go on reading a book like this. An added bonus of that particular tale is that I no longer regard red traffic lights in a completely, negative light. One of the more curious facts about grieving is that it can kick in well before the patient dies. Not only that, the patients themselves can grieve their own deaths. This may sound strange, but they certainly will not have a chance to do so after the fact. Joking aside, you can certainly feel sad in advance about missing loved ones as well as about the pain they will feel once you are gone. Or a patient may mourn other losses he must endure on the way to the grand finale of death itself. Greta, a patient who was gradually losing more and more of her physical functions due to a neurological disease, told me,
"For each loss of something I could do and can't do now, like no longer being able to move my arm, but just my fingers, I have my own private funeral for it."
This struck me as one of the all-out saddest statements I have ever heard from a patient on hospice. Talking about facing one's death well in advance, I had a 97-year-old patient who could be witheringly blunt about her concerns about her own death, as well as just about everything else. Mrs. Wilson usually turned down my offers to visit, but accepted them just often enough for me to keep trying as I made my rounds in the assisted living section. Her refusals were very abrupt and off-putting, so I had to coax myself to keep giving a knock on her door and not give up. One day, she was seated by a small round table sorting through her mail and deigned to let me in. "For a few minutes, but that's all." She delegated the task to me, throwing away each rejected piece one by one. Apparently they, and not I, were the object of rejection that day. A wastebasket dutifully stood within tossing range, just waiting to gobble up as many such pieces as it could, as if saying, "Feed me," like the ever more demanding plant in Little Shop of Horrors. Mrs. Wilson was mourning her own end, which she could not have been blunter about. She assailed me with question after question concerning her impending non-existence. It was all I could do to force myself to keep my eyes on her face and not hem and haw. Looking at me as if ready to confirm I would disappoint her by having no answer, she asked, "How do I prepare to die? What do I tell my children?" I talked of reviewing loose ends in relationships and of pondering her legacy, but she rejected those options as readily as the doomed pieces of mail. "I have no loose ends to resolve," she retorted. Given some mutterings over certain family members during former visits, I knew this was hardly the case, but there was no reason to challenge her. When someone's not ready to examine an element in their lives, then they will ignore any urging to do so. They will not even hear it. Furthermore, I believe that some of the things chaplains and social workers and therapists say to people they serve are like time capsules. After the visit is long over, the patients may choose to release those words into their consciousness and let themselves ponder their implications. Words that initially were jarring can soothingly cleanse away hurts that had been held in bondage for a good period of time. Before I left, Mrs. Wilson went on to say that my responses to her questions confused her. So, Mrs. Wilson was already considering the provocative implications of my answers, while I was left wondering what she had hoped to hear me clarify. As I said, grief does not occur in a neatly packaged period of time with a clear beginning and a clear end. Grieving does not even necessarily begin at the time a loved one dies. It can start for the family long before the event, especially if the patient can no longer communicate or does so only in severely limited ways. Grief can extend long afterwards as well, much longer than most of our friends and relatives are willing to believe, who disappear from the scene when mourners need them more than ever. This extended grief can, given the circumstances, still be within normal limits, as the nurses like to say. Even after several years, a certain event, thought, experience, or smell may suddenly stir up the sense of loss for a little while. This business of trying to shortcut mourning came up as I was set to officiate at an unveiling, which is a Jewish ritual at the graveside at approximately the first anniversary of the death. Several family members and I were standing around our cars waiting for the rest of the family to arrive before we all proceeded to the graveside. A nephew, perhaps waiting to impress me with his knowledge about unveilings, proudly announced to me, "A rabbi once said, unveilings are not for grieving. They're for celebrating the person's life. The grieving is done at the funeral." "The unveiling is a time for happiness." That is what he told me, anyway. As the nephew said this, not only was I aware that this was wrong, or at best just part of the story, but I was concerned about other people listening to us who perhaps did not feel very jolly at all on that occasion. If anything, being at the grave might trigger a surge of sadness or anxiety, so for their sake, as I did not want anyone to suppress their feelings as illegitimate, I simply had to correct him. Actually, each person mourns differently. The unveiling marks another stage in our mourning journey. It acknowledges that the pain is not as sharp, but there still may be sorrow as well as joyful memories. In a way, the nephew may have had the last word, as during the ceremony we all heard Scott Joplin's The Entertainer gurgling from an ice cream truck cruising within earshot of the grave. The assemblage was starting to giggle, so I knew I had to comment on it to eventually restore more decorum. "There are signs of the pleasures of life everywhere, even here in the cemetery." They laughed in affirmation, and were then better able to focus on the remaining prayers and reminiscences. After the ceremony, one of the sons of the deceased offered another sort of reflective comment, which he was so taken with that he repeated it to me a few times. "You know, our lives go on like those reel-to-reel tape recorders, the kind of recorders we used to have. In the beginning, when all the tape is on one reel, the reel moves nice and slowly. But as you get further along, there is less and less tape, and the reel moves very, very fast. Funny how life is like that. Every year speeds up more and more." This has to be the most imaginative way I have heard anyone rephrase the tired comment, "The older we get, the faster time goes," which even a centenarian had resignedly said to me. As an aside, I have to say that I have not felt that way about my own life. That may be because I frequently go from one new thing to another, not letting much time pass before I leave one routine for another. I have a severe case of the novelty gene. I think when there is not much change in one's routine, then time seems to pass more quickly. Conversely, when I was in a profound crisis like 9/11, I felt like time did not move at all. I felt that way during the 9/11 emergency for a good 2 weeks. Mourners, too, sometimes initially have this sensation of time coming to a halt. There is another sort of time warping that mourners experience. Very often, they feel a pressing need to review and review the months and weeks and days and even hours before their loved ones passed, as if this relatively tiny percentage of his or her life overshadowed much of what went before. One year in May, about 5 weeks after Passover, I met with Ruth, whose mother had died almost a week earlier. I had attended the Shiva, which for some Jewish mourners is a period of anywhere from 1 day to 7, when people visit the home of the mourners and in some cases gather to recite prayers with them. After everybody else had gone, taking the soothing warmth of their familiar faces and conversation with them, I had the feeling that Ruth wanted to talk about her mother, even though she had not done so with the other visitors. Sure enough, my bereavement radar was right. As I looked at the homemade religious pictures all around the living room, Ruth started telling me about how her mother was starting to take a turn for the worse around Passover. She had not been eating all that much, especially since for 1 week much of the fare in her strictly kosher nursing home consisted of the unleavened crackers called matzah. During Passover, observant Jews do not eat bread or other leavened items, and so they eat, among other things, matzah, which is hard and dry, instead of bread, which is comparatively filling and soft and moist. As far-fetched as it may seem, Ruth was about to tell a very funny story about her mom. During this one-week regimen imposed on all residents who were not exempted for health reasons, her mom became a very dissatisfied customer, and therefore was even less inclined to eat. Ruth, knowing full well that her mother's life was drawing to a close, wanted to please her in any way she could. She asked her what she would like most to eat, if given the chance. "Bacon and eggs," she said decisively. Taken aback, Ruth repeated, Bacon and eggs? From her mom's expression, she meant what she said, and there was no getting around the fact that this quintessentially non-kosher dish was among her last wishes. Ruth instantly concluded that the commandment to honor thy mother and father trumped any dietary laws, even on Passover with its more daunting ones to obey. So she decided to try and sneak in the controversial cuisine. All curious as I could be, I asked, how did you manage to get past the kosher food police? In a satisfied tone, she continued,
I went to a diner, ordered the bacon and eggs, and had them packed for takeout. I had a huge purse, one of the squarish-looking ones, and so I stuck them in there. I then went back to the nursing home, and as I got in the elevator, I prayed that no one would notice.
And in the view of highly observant Jews, here she was, praying to God to allow her to get away with breaking one of God's own laws. Incredible, I said. Seems like someone would have noticed the telltale smell.
I don't know. Somehow I managed to sneak it into her room. She ate some of it and was very, very pleased about it. I felt I had to tell the nurse. The nurses there are not Jewish. Just to say that my mother did eat. Not to say what she ate. Just that she ate. Because, you know, they needed to write down whenever mother ate. Because she had not been eating so much. So the nurse did that. Just wrote that my mom ate without saying what exactly.
I resisted the temptation to say I was eating up her words. And instead reasoned, I suppose the nurse did that because she was afraid of getting in trouble. What did you do with the rest of the contraband your mom didn't finish? With not even a ghost of a smile, she intently went on.
A health aide was nice enough to wrap it up good and get it the hell out of there. And what I did was the right thing to do. It was what my mother wanted. And she had not been eating.
I agreed wholeheartedly with her. Besides, even the most observant rabbis adhere to the notion that when commands are in conflict with each other, certain ones regarding the preservation of life, in this case encouraging eating, trump all the rest. Only superficially was Ruth doing something wrong. On so many other levels, she was doing something so very right. On the heels of that anecdote, Ruth rushed on to tell me another one of her mother's last wishes, which was,
I will not close my eyes until you and your brother get along with each other again.
Happily, over the past few years, when her brother and sister had to end an estrangement in order to cooperate sufficiently to ensure proper care for their mother, they gradually became quite loving to each other, just in time for her to rejoice in that reunion before she, in fact, closed her eyes for the very last time. Often, mourners talk with me about their loved one's final months, weeks, or even days. The patients themselves talk about the recent past as well, but with a little encouragement, they often think back to turning points all throughout their past. It does not take much prompting from me for them to reminisce about their families, their careers, and their special interests and accomplishments. If you think about it, we all like to do this. So why would it be any different when we're near the end? If anything, we have more of our lives to look back on.